Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Diffuse Large B-Cell Lymphomas. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Jill Sal from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. In addition to this interview program, there's also a corresponding presentation program with Dr. Sal's slides. To begin, I asked him how he thinks about the biology of transformed large cell lymphoma, both from indolent lymphomas as well as CLL.
I think biology has taught us a couple of things in the last few years. And when we examine the different molecular subtype of DLBCL, how they were presented and examined either by the group of Lushtot or by the group of Margaret Shipp, there is clearly a hint here that some of the DLBCLs and some of the subgroup have features that correspond to some indolent malignancies. So it looks like B-cell may transform in different ways. And the best example is follicular and germinal center B-cell / EZB with EZH2 and BCL2 mutation. They have very common mutations. So it looks like the cell may drive either in a direction of an indolent or an aggressive or an indolent and then an aggressive. There are different models for that, but I will say there is a common ground. This is probably true for marginal zone lymphoma and the so-called BN6 entity, as well as for lymphoplasmocytic / Waldenström and the MYD88 / MCD subtype. So there is a common ground with some DLBCL. So I will say, obviously, clinically, it's very different to handle a patient that had a history of an indolent lymphoma, then transformed and had already received treatment from one that is kind of de novo, but may have particular features reminiscent of this indolent subtype. But I will say all of them are diffuse large B. Richter is slightly different because I think we still don't understand very well the biology of Richter. There are a lot of pathway, and probably the way they respond to therapy has been always disappointing in terms of people doing DLBCL. I have seen very superficially this abstract. I was just talking with my colleague here doing CLL, one of my colleagues, and I think that we have to be a little bit careful with early result with Richter's. I mean, I will say in the last 10, 15 years, I have seen a couple of drugs telling this is effective, immune checkpoint, venetoclax, things like that. And when we had confirmative trials, they were disappointing. So it's still very challenging, much more than transform follicular or transform marginal or something like that, which now with especially CAR T cell, for instance, have a better outcome. So yeah, I think we learn more that there is probably a common ground in the way B cell transform, leading to either indolent or aggressive disease or indolent and then aggressive disease.
So yeah, they were mentioning that last night, the fact that, you know, a lot of things you see responses and then the responses don't last too long. The other thing is in terms of BTK inhibitors. So again, there was this paper at ASH where they saw a bunch of responses. We'll see, you know, it's a pirtobrutinib. And so I was asking, has pirtobrutinib been looked at? Because I know there have been some studies like with ibrutinib in diffuse large B-cell, but has pirtobrutinib, the non-covalent, been looked at in diffuse large B-cell?
Up to my knowledge, there haven't been publicly reports of the activity, or maybe in the very initial phase one, but that wasn't really the goal. I think we may have to revisit a little bit the BTK inhibitor in lymphoma in general. You know, I used to say, for instance, that ibrutinib had no role in follicular, given the fact that the confirmative phase two was negative. But then we heard last year in follicular the result of zanubrutinib in combination with obinutuzumab. And, you know, the field may be relaunched. There may be different combination. It's a little bit the same for diffuse large B, where, you know, the Phoenix data with ibrutinib plus R-CHOP were negative, but there is a subset of very well molecularly defined patients that respond. So we have to continue to work in this field, and we should not throw the baby of BTK inhibitor with the bath and keep them as investigational drug in this setting.
Another sort of macro question, and, you know, this may seem really basic, but, you know, I'm sure people have these thoughts, which is, any comment in terms of why it is that you see cure in diffuse large B-cell, both up front and even on relapse, and you don't really see, that I know of, cure with, for example, indolent lymphoma or, I mean, CLL for that matter. What is it biologically you think that, why do we see cures?
I don't think we have a good answer to this question of why do we cure aggressive lymphoma and don't cure indolent lymphoma. But a very simplistic explanation that we had years ago was that, you know, rapidly dividing cells are more susceptible to chemotherapy than quiescent cells. And quiescent cells are probably the usual reservoir of relapses in follicular lymphoma or CLL. I think it's a little bit a simplistic approach. Maybe with targeted agent, we will learn more. Maybe with immune-based therapy, we'll learn more. And, you know, we see now more and more follicular lymphoma treated 10, 15 years ago that haven't relapsed after frontline treatment. We see also long-term remission in CLL with, you know, FCR, but also with, you know, combination right. with targeted agents. So we may have to think about, you know, challenging a little bit further this concept of incurable indolent diseases in the future. And I hope we'll be able to challenge it.
These four agents that you talked about, polatuzumab in combination with BR, Lonca-T, tafasitamab, L-MIND, and selinexor. In patients who, let's just put aside CAR-T, assume they're not eligible for CAR-T, let's put aside bispecifics for the moment. I'm curious, ideally, how you would like to sequence these agents and also what your experience is with quality life on these agents, particularly selinexor, I'm curious about, because I know docs in practice have kind of struggled with selinexor and myeloma, and I'm just wondering how it plays out in diffuse large B-cell, but also the other three options, how you compare the toxicity, convenience, et cetera, and how you, right now, again, sort of putting aside CAR-T and bispecifics, sequencing.
Yes, I think we don't have clear guidelines, and it's only the experience. I will say, let's talk a little bit about selinexor. It's a challenging drug. It has an efficacy that exists, but is limited in terms of number of patients. But if you want to treat patients, as I said, you need to really intervene, monitor, help them to go through this drug. I do know anecdotes from colleagues having seen patients over 1 year with this drug and patients that were previously refractory. So there may be some very ideal patients, but as shown on this slide, we cannot identify them. So it may be worth trying in some patients, but I will say very few of us has an extended experience of this drug because very few of us use it in real life. So despite anecdotes here and there, I cannot say, you know, that we are very enthusiastic to use this drug compared to the three others. Regarding the three others, I think we have different profile of side effect. I mean, BR Pola is a classical chemo regimen. Patients are coming regularly. What is really interesting with Pola BR is that we get this 40% response rate, CR rate, even in patients that are refractory. And I think it's, you know, you do see patients, you may not expect that. And they are in CR and some of them maintain CR. And it's a good regimen. And it's, I will say, manageable like any other chemo-based regimen. Infections, neutropenia are a common side effect. If we go to tafa-len, I think it's a pretty well-tolerated regimen, but it's cumbersome. And it's cumbersome because patients have to come three times in the first week and then every week for the first 3 months. Then you have to manage the toxicity that is associated with len. We have some patients with rashes. We have some neutropenia, some thrombocytopenia. I will say that in my personal experience, I haven't seen, you know, patients that need a platelet transfusion. I haven't seen febrile neutropenia. But then I probably use len at a lower dose than the one in the trial and tend to rapidly diminish len when I see some heme toxicity appearing. But, you know, I have, again, treated some patients. They are in CR. We have a few patients that are in CR for more than 1 year. The remaining question for this regimen is, besides this probably limited activity in truly refractory patient, is how long should we continue the drug? And, you know, the trial was designed as 1 year of combination of TAFA plus LEN, and then tafasitamab continued until progression. I think this kind of schema in DLBCL has never been validated. And I will say when a patient with a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is in CR for 6 months, maybe take it for 12 months, it's very hard for me to justify to continue treatment. And I will say this is a discussion I have with my patient when I use this drug. But again, there are anecdotes of at least one patient I know that interrupted and relapsed 3 months later. Whether it was changing if we had continued the drug or not, I have no idea. Finally, Lonca is probably the most recent drug. And I will say it's a drug that's quite manageable. Some patients tolerate it well. And if the drug is available for some patients in the third line setting, which is his indication, we should really think about it because besides, you know, the heme toxicity and the limited edema that patients have, the biological abnormalities, liver, have really no clinical consequences. And you know, patients tolerate that well. So again, a subset of patients have a CR and prolonged CR. So these are great options. After that, in terms of sequencing, you just have to take into consideration two things. If patients are not eligible for CAR T, but may become eligible or may consider CAR T later, may eventually overcome the obstacles to get CAR T in terms of distance to CAR T centers or fear of the side effect, you may want to avoid bendamustine before collecting CAR T, given the fact that it's a T cell depleting agent. There are no clear answers regarding the exposure of lymphoma to both tafasitamab and loncastuximab, which both target CD19 on the surface of B-cell as well as CAR-T. The data appear to be reassuring, but you may want to preserve an interval between the infusion of CAR-T and the lat administration of this drug. So, you know, there are different options here. I will say that I will prefer to use tafasitamab lenalidomide on lonca-T in patients that fail CAR-T but are still CD19 positive. I will really restrict BR-POLA for patients that are not candidate for CAR-T or eventually bridging them after the collection, but that's only in one cycle. And after that, we can discuss with the patient, you know, the convenience coming very often to the center with tafa-len, the little side effect in terms of heme toxicity of lonca-T or the more classical schedule of BR-POLA. Again, it's a discussion from patient to patient.
So, yeah, it's interesting. You were talking about selinexor, and I was just, you know, again, I get, you know, hear all these stories. I've seen a lot of oncologists, they try it once and, you know, they don't try it again. We had Joseph McHale, a myeloma, on a webinar a couple weeks ago, and he was like all excited about selinexor. He has a lot of people have been on it a long time. He has his whole nursing staff that, you know, is all over these patients. They use a very intensive pre-medication. And, you know, he's one of the few doctors who, you know, kind of speaks positively, but I kind of wonder whether or not, you know, maybe it, you know, it does have activity if you could figure out a way to give it, you know, more comfortably.
No, it has activity. The question is, you know, you have a 30% response rate. Maybe if you give it with more supportive measure, you will have a little bit of increase of that, but the CR rate may still be limited. So, you know, compared to other agents that are presently available, it's very hard to say. But, you know, again, anecdotes of patients refractory to many chemos and still on drug for a prolonged period. You just, as you said, have to really accompany patient with supportive measure, have nurses monitoring the patient for their weight, for their appetite, using antiemetic, using olanzapine, for instance, or other drugs that will fight against, you know, this kind of syndrome of waste, or you can use, like we use in the old days of oncology, progestatives, eventually, you know, steroids, you know, to try to bring back patients in better shape.
Interesting. I'm curious, particularly in terms of tafasitamab, lonca-T, and selinexor, what the plans are or strategies are in terms of future developments. You know, you already talked about the Polarix trial and how POLA was brought up front. But yet you have so much going on with bispecifics and CAR T. What's the thinking about lonca-T, tafasitamab, and selinexor in terms of new trials?
So I think, as you said, with polatuzumab, if it's broad frontline, I mean, we will use eventually for one or two cycles, you know, when we want to control the disease before CAR T collection or for bridging. But I think it will not be a standard regimen for patients who have received it in frontline. Regarding tafasitamab, lenalidomide, I think there is a trial which is called FrontMIND or FirstMIND, which is a trial combining tafasitamab, lenalidomide with R-CHOP. It's a randomized study. It's still accruing, up to my knowledge. And I think we'll hear the result in maybe 1, 2, 3 years. I don't know exactly. The phase two data showed that it was feasible to combine, but maybe with some heme toxicity. And we will see how it fits. And, you know, it's a very competitive field right now. Besides that, I think there have been no major trials that will fairly position this combination in the setting. The same is a little bit true for Loncati, who has had a hard time to find a new space. Now it was probably the last one to come. I think Loncati may still have development in patients that are not fit for chemotherapy with different combination. But again, in a competition which is fierce with bispecific and polatuzumab and others, I think it's, again, a drug that needs to be probably reevaluated. The mechanism of resistance to this antibody drug conjugate has not been clearly understood. And, you know, if Pola moves in the frontline setting using an antibody drug conjugate with a different toxin, maybe a nice approach, because you may kill the cell by a different mechanism and because you are not able to reuse Pola. Regarding selinexor, I'm aware of a few trials with combination of chemo, but they were probably hard to develop. And I think what is interesting is that there were some attempts to develop a second generation of drugs targeting the same pathway. And if this comes true and it's better tolerable, that will be an interesting drug.
When you think about bispecifics, any of these agents from a biologic or pharmacologic point of view that would make sense to combine with bispecifics?
Well, if we have thinking in terms of mode of action, I will say bispecific are working immunologically, so you will like to attempt to work them with other immunologically based drug. So I think obviously lenalidomide is here, and that's what is investigated in trial in follicular lymphoma. With tafasitamab and lenalidomide, yes, this could be an approach, but you are bringing three expensive drugs here. You have really to show a benefit. With antibody drug conjugate, obviously, there are trials with polatuzumab and mosunetuzumab, for instance, which are interesting. I think it's rather completing mode of actions rather than synergistic. It's additional effect rather than synergy.
So with the approval of mosunetuzumab, also teclistamab in myeloma, and as you're saying, you know, a couple here on diffuse-large B-cell likely to come into practice. Of course, the general medical oncologist is asking, are we going to be able to give these drugs? And I'm curious, first of all, in a way, it's hard, I think, to separate out how complicated it is to give one versus the other. They all cause CR, you know, it's kind of like they all come together in my mind. Even teclistamab, I can't even separate from the lymphoma drugs. From your point of view, when you think about, let's just stick with the bispecifics that you just discussed for diffuse large B-cell, how would you compare the challenge in giving them, you know, CRS, the time sequence, and do you think it's feasible for a general medical oncologist to utilize these drugs now or in the future? What does it take to be able to give the drug? I don't even know. I assume most oncologists don't even have tocilizumab available. I don't think, do they?
Well, they tend to have in large practices eventually, but, you know, right. It's still challenging for them. I think this is a main challenge, I will say, for bispecific antibodies, especially those two drugs, glofitamab and teclistamab. Bringing back Mosun a little bit differently, there are less grade 3-4, and, you know, sub-Q formulation will come in the future for follicular in 2 years. And I will say it's probably more easily manageable, but as you may have seen, it's a little bit less potent for DLBCL. So the development in DLBCL as single agent will focus on these two drugs or in combination in these two drugs. So I think there is really a challenge for the first month of therapy. And I will say what I'm rather an optimistic person and a reassuring person. I think it's probably not feasible to use this drug alone in your own practice without a strong supportive team, whether eventually helping the patient to monitor the risk of CRS with fever, with potentially a pulse oximeter. But that's very challenging in a single practice. So if patient community oncology have lab practice, have, you know, nursing support or physician assistant support, well, I think they can organize that. And I will say it's really a minority of patients that will receive TOSI. It's a minority of patients that will need to be hospitalized. But again, you have to organize yourself with an hospital that is able to understand why do these patients come and what do they have to do. So there is a lot of education to be made here, and that will be the main challenge. But I will say it's essentially for the first month. So our larger centers are able to collaborate with more community oncology practice. I mean, we aim to do that, and I'm happy to help, and many of us are happy to help because it brings a benefit to patients. But, you know, clearly managing the first months needs some organization, some trained people, and ability to readmit the patient, you know, 1-2 days after each injection. It's only temporary, so that's reasonable. It has nothing to do with the toxicity of CAR T. It's very limited in time. There is much less severe event. ICANS, you know, neurological event, are essentially of grade 1-2, and they are very rare. But, you know, it needs to be managed.
What about eligibility for treatment? I kind of am getting the feeling that it's going to be like, you know, the other non-CAR T eligible, you know, Loncati, Tafalin, you know, most people are going to be able to get bispecifics.
I think, you know, the approval is targeting the third line setting. So after, you know, patients failing two lines of therapy, many patients will have received CAR T, and it's quite encouraging to see that these drugs are efficient in patients that fail CAR T. I've shown the data of EPCOR, but these are similar data for Glofit. I will say there is no possibility to differentiate these two drugs in terms of efficacy and safety at this time. It's just maybe one is convenient because of the sub-Q, but we have to see more mature result. I will say, you know, there are some frail patients that are older patients with severe comorbidities in which a CRS can be very challenging, even a grade 2 CRS. You know, if you have to admit this patient, if they have to administer fluid, if the patient have to remain on oxygen for 24, 48 hours, you know, that's not a home run. So I will say, in theory, everybody is eligible. In practice, I think there are some patients that remains probably not very good candidate for this drug. I will say that overall, I feel you can, with adequate supportive team, use this drug in almost every patient. But if the patient have to stay inpatient, that's a major limitation. So we'll have to see how things run. You know, it's very different, the approval from FDA for the myeloma glioid Tislelizumab versus Mosun. Mosun had no REMS and has just a black box regarding the CRS risk. So, you know, we'll have to see how these two comes up. They're probably somewhere intermediate, but we will see. And I will say, talking also on our own experience, we should be more liberal with the use of steroids. And maybe we'll learn more by using more preventive steroids, keeping the patient taking steroids at home at day 2. Most of the CRS occur like, you know, not like 2-4 hours after the administration of the drug, but 12, 16, 24 hours. So these patients are not in your practice anymore. But if you have prophylaxis with steroids, if they have steroids immediately in their hands, they don't have to go to the pharmacy to get them back, and you can tell them, okay, you have fever, let's take steroids, let's repeat steroid at 4 p.m. You may have a bad night, you may not sleep, but you may probably limit again the number of grade 2 or 3 events and be able to monitor better the patient. I think that's probably what we have to learn. And also what we have to learn is to identify the patient at high risk of CRS. And so far, we haven't seen convincing data, but I think this will be very important.
Just to finish out on eligibility, what's your vision in terms of eligibility for CAR T, particularly, let's say, as compared to autologous transplant? First of all, from an age point of view, what's the oldest patient you've sent to CAR T? And how do you view, what do you look at when you think specific, you know, not just performance status, but what else are you looking at when you decide about CAR-T? And are there a lot of patients who you think can get CAR-T who, for example, would not be eligible for autologous transplant?
Yes, there is clearly a much wider range of patients that are eligible for CAR-T and were not good candidate for transplant. Even in some of them, we were pushing them for transplant. So I think the toxicity profile is different, and many patients can go through CAR-T, especially with the for 1BB product without major side effect. Having said that, what do I look for? I will say there is no age limit. Probably we treated a few weeks ago, months ago, a patient of 92. Whether that would be my preferred treatment, I don't know, but you know, it's acceptable. So there is no age limit. The limitations are some of the comorbidities that may really impair our ability to manage the side effect. And among those are a poor cardiac ejection fraction. If you have a cardiac ejection fraction of less than 30%, this is clearly not a candidate for CAR-T. If the patient have, you know, medium cardiac ejection fractions, but, you know, CKI and, you know, some other comorbidities, a performance status of 2, well, this is not a candidate. But I will say, besides that, the major patients that I found not eligible or very difficult to manage are those patients with a pace of disease that unfortunately is not compatible with CAR-T. These patients with, you know, rapidly progressive disease, high LDH, that you are in difficulty with controlling during bridging, that need to be stabilized. You know, you need to perform the collection, you know, exactly 3-4 weeks after a cycle of chemo, and you have eventually the rebound of the disease. So I think that's where we need to improve, you know, and, you know, obviously treating them at the first relapse will help, but there are still patients quite difficult to manage here. And I will say a few patients are not candidate because of that. So maybe, you know, when bispecific are approved, maybe we can improve the eligibility for CAR-T. We don't have to oppose these drugs. Maybe, you know, a wiser management. I think what is very important is to discuss CAR-T early on nowadays. Besides the approval of the two products in the patient with early relapse and refractory disease, liso-cel has also an approval for second-line non-transplant eligible patient, which obviously broaden, as you may have heard, and you know, the production line of this product is not perfect, and there are still waiting time, and we don't get the product as we wish we have. But when the company will have sold that, and we hope they will, it will completely broaden the number of patients that are eligible for CAR. And obviously, there is a distance to the CAR-T centers, there is caregivers. You know, given that, I think that we'll see the result of bispecific in the long term, whether patients achieving a CR have maintained CR, because they may challenge the CAR-T even in the second line setting for this patient sometime. So let me discuss three cases to illustrate what we have discussed. The first case is a patient which I have seen recently. He is 67. He was diagnosed with DLBCL, has a previous medical history of mitral valve repair, but biological valve, not taking blood thinner, ulcerative colitis, just topically treated, and was being vaccinated with COVID. He had a left half arm tumor in soft tissues, very visible on the patient, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, non-GCB, high or median high proliferation index. It was called double expressor by on the double expression of c-MYC and BCL2 protein, and the FISH was negative for BCL2, MYC, and BCL6. We found minimal bone marrow involvement, but by typically large B-cell, and the LDH were elevated. So in fact, this patient had stage 4 disease, a very good performance status. If we look at the IPI score, he's older than 60, elevated LDH, stage 4, 2 extranodal cells of disease. So he's in the 4 IPI items, so high risk group. So, you know, the PFS estimate with R-CHOP is 50-55%. And he has a medium risk of CNS recurrence. So the question is, what did I offer to this patient? What I discussed with him? I think we had one clinical trial that he said he didn't want to participate. That was a randomized trial. And you know, we discussed the possibility of using PolarArt chip, and I outline on this slide again the differences seen in patients with a high IPI or with a double expressor. And again, taken that with a lot of caution, given the fact that these are subgroup analyses, but you can see that the difference in terms of 2 years PFS here is 10. So we propose him for PolarArt chip, and it was approved by his insurance. And I think he's receiving his 4 cycles right now. And he had a very good response at interim PET with Deauville score of 2. We had discussed the CNS prophylaxis, and at this time we are not really convinced this is a routine practice for patient. And given these features that he had, we decided not to go for any CNS prophylaxis for him.
Can you describe situations where you do use CNS prophylaxis and what CNS prophylaxis you use?
So there are some very specific groups. The first one are clearly patients with double hit lymphoma, high-grade B-cell lymphoma. We usually use dose-adjusted IPOC, and we use intrathecal with dose-adjusted IPOC, how it was described in the initial regimen, rather than high-dose methotrexate. There is then the patient with very specific localization. The most demonstrative one is patient with testicular lymphoma, and we tend to use IV high-dose methotrexate at the end after completing R-CHOP. Then there are this patient with higher risk, and I will say it's a patient-per-patient decision. We propose it to some patient with high risk, probably similar to the one that we just described. I think with him there was a discussion, and we explained to him the risk, and he was not really interested in going the password. But I will say in a similar patients, almost some patients have said, yes, let's go for it. So I think we have to explain to the patient that this is 2 additional cycles, requiring usually an inpatient stay, monitoring of methotrexate eliminations, and there is no demonstrated activity. So, you know, some patients are willing to say, okay, there is no data, let's be aside. Some patients say, even if there is a very small risk, I prefer to go for these 2 additional courses. We have a fair discussion with the patient, but right now I only propose it for the one I just described. You have to include also adrenal as a localization and renal. So testicular, adrenal, renal, advanced IPI and high LDH and advanced age. And, you know, I think we need to generate more data in this field, and maybe it will be either confirmed in some patients or abandoned.
So what's the follow-up on this patient? The patient just progressed?
No. Well, I was making that in theory. And
oh, you were making that?
I made that because obviously this is typically a patient that I will say he's finishing his treatment. If there was any progression that were observed, what will be the recommendation? And I think that's just to exemplify that these are typically patients that are candidate for CAR T. So I made that up, I have to recognize.
Okay. No, I was like, whoa, that's not good. But that's great that that was more of a theoretical thing.
Yeah.
So incidentally, for a patient like this, what kind of CAR T would you generally utilize?
I think this patient is in very good shape. He's 67, performance status of 0, no comorbidities. I will go for the first available. Is the first available is axi-cel, like it is usually. I will say I will go for axi. If by chance I have a liso-cel available within a very reasonable time frame, I will go for liso-cel. So my preference will be liso-cel, given the better toxicity profile, but right now, I mean, sometimes the waiting time to collection is 3-4 weeks, and that's not always compatible with the management of the patients.
So before you tell us about your 82-year-old patient, what happened with the 92-year-old who got CAR-T?
He went well. I mean, he got actually liso-cel also. And, you know, he went. He had CRS grade 1, and he went out, and he, you know, CRS grade 1 is what, 2-3 days of fever and a little bit of steroids. So patient goes in the residence near the hospital at day 10 or 11, you know, they come 3 times a week until day 30, sometimes only 2 times a week if nothing happens. And they can go home after that and be seen every month and just to monitor for CR. He reached a CR and that was at 1 month. I don't have some follow-up, but I think we are encouraging. Obviously, I will privilege that for, I will say, good candidates, which are patients with not major bulky disease, not high LDH, because this patient can go quite well within the CAR-T process and tolerate it well and have a long-term benefit.
Awesome. How about your 82-year-old woman?
Well, this is another woman who has a funny history because I saw her 1.5 years ago. Woman with hypertension, hypothyroidism, and a mild obesity. She had a history of follicular lymphoma that was treated with R-CHOP 19 years ago. So a very prolonged response to first-line therapy of follicular lymphoma. We haven't seen her at that time. In the summer of 2021, she had a disease recurrence with groin lymphadenopathy, retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy, good performance status, normal LDH. She got a biopsy of the groin lymphadenopathy and was decided that this was follicular lymphoma. She received 6 cycles of R-Benda. But at the end of the treatment with R-Benda, she came up, as you can see, in February with this PET scan showing the regrowth of this left side groin lymphadenopathy. The biology was, the histology was diffuse large B cell. So it was a transformed disease. So the decision, 82 years old, CAR-T, non-CAR-T, third line of therapy, you know, she hasn't been treated twice for diffuse large B cell. So we kind of pushed a little bit saying, you know, maybe in summer 2021, she had already diffuse large B. So we decided to take her to Tafa-Len. Len was started at 15 milligrams per day because she had a creatinine clearance around 50. And tafasitamab was used according to the L-MIND schedule. And, you know, it's a transformed disease. And basically what we saw is that Tafa-Len was started in March. That's the first PET. That's a PET scan probably 2 months ago in June showing a CR. And that's a PET scan, which is more recent, showing the prolongation of CR. We are now, as you can see, almost 9 months. The question now is that recently in November 2022, she developed COVID. She had also mild aldemia, which we cannot really well explain. And the question is, well, typically, should we discontinue Len and tafasitamab? Should we discontinue only Len and continue Tafa alone? And if yes, for how long? So I have seen this patient a few days ago. She was still anemic and still not fully recovered for COVID. So treatment has been interrupted since now almost 5-6 weeks. But I see her next week and I will propose her to continue Tafa alone for, you know, 6 months. She's in CR. I don't think I should treat her for a long time. I think it has very limited toxicity when it's used alone. But again, that's clearly the debatable case we have.
So, you know, that's very interesting. Let's talk about your last case, the 42-year-old woman.
Yeah, that's a 42-year-old woman, not very easy to handle. As you see, she's a mother of two already at 42, recurrent ITI and management in healthcare has not been always optimal. She was diagnosed with DLBCL in the summer of 2021 and received 6 cycles of R-CHOP in an outside institution, had an interim PET that remained positive and unfortunately progressed 3 months after completion. I have discussed with her oncologist and I will not have changed the management according to the interim PET, but I will have been careful for the risk of recurrence, but this had not prevented it. So the biopsy at the time of DLBCL recurrence showed DLBCL, so she was referred to me for CAR-T, and I think we bridged her with 1 cycle of BR-POLA after collecting the CAR-T, and she was stable after BR-POLA. She didn't respond to this regimen, and she received axi-cel at the end of July 2022, as you can see. And she had at this time, as you can see, a mediastinal tumor, an adrenal tumor, and maybe a little spot here, mandibular. So she received axi-cel. I think she has grade 1 grade 1 or maybe grade 2 for one day, CRS, received steroid on TOSI, but was discharged quite well. No neurological events at all. The issue is that 2 months after CAR T, as you can see, she had persistent disease in the mediastinum and in the adrenal region. So there is always a debate of when do you reevaluate this patient, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. We do know that there are some patients that complete their response, are in partial response at 1 month and complete to a CR at 2 or 3 months. But I felt that this patient who had, you know, early failure, was young, we needed to document very early whether she was refractory or not. And we actually approached the adrenal site as a biopsy, which demonstrated again the LBCL. So, you know, it's a young woman, and I will say, despite some difficulties in management and I will say comprehension of her past towards treatment of her lymphoma, we thought we should try to bring her in CR and offer her the possibility of an allogeneic transplant given her young age. And given the fact that the few patients that receive allogeneic transplant after CAR T appear to have a sustained benefit. So given the fact that she still expressed CD19 on her biopsy, actually CD19 of CD20, I offered her to start Lonca, and as you can imagine, this was rather recent, but I just restaged her just before Christmas. And that's actually her staging with probably essentially 3 infusion of Lonca. And as you can see, she's appears to be responding. So I will restage her in another month, a month and a half. We are basically doing the typing, and I hope that we can really envision to bring him to allo. And that was just to demonstrate, you know, the efficacy of a CD19 based therapy after CAR T, when CD19 remains expressed. It's a different mode of action. And we will also bridge her using radiation on these 2 spots, that are the mediastinal and maybe the adrenal region, if there is anything still left on the more clear examination of the PET. But, you know, there is, as we said, most of the patients that fail CAR T are not doing well, and many of them have a very poor outcome. But there are a few patients that can be managed with new agents and eventually brought to another line of therapy. And I hope that we'll be able, now that we are using CAR T in second line, bring some option to these patients.
Yeah, it's really interesting. She responded to Lonca T, but yet didn't, I guess she never responded to CAR T.
Yeah.
Were you saying, is the thinking that actually patients respond better to allo after CAR T? Is there any synergy there, or not at all?
No, that's not at all. It's just, if you're able to bring a patient that had received CAR T in a complete response, and this is a very minority of this patient, and this patient is eligible for allo, there is actually a series of patients from the US published just online in Hematologica. Alex Herrera is a senior author of the first author of this series from City of Hope. And we have also a paper from a Memorial, which hasn't just been published also. And I think both papers suggest that there is a little group of patients that, despite having failed CAR T, can be brought into CR and can be brought for allo. I mean, it's well known that I'm not a big supporter of allogeneic in DLBCL, but we just have to think that there are a few patients in which we can manage. And yeah, some of these patients are probably cured a few years later. So let's keep that in mind as a possibility.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Sal, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.